Blog Talk Radio.
Special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
Yo, what's up, what's going on? And this is the Boxing Source Radio Show. And this is the March 3rd podcast. And you are here live currently with your host, James Bell. I am the lead boxing analyst for the Cold Hard Truth on sports. Catch boxing articles and more at thechtonsports.com. Once again, that is thechtonsports.com. The hotline is 347-237-5539. Once again, 347-237-5539. Press the one key to get on cue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. We got like a couple of matches to cover from, you know, the previous weekend's action, and we'll take a look ahead to what's coming up on Saturday, March 9th. There's going to be a few titles that will be on the line here. So once we get into all of that, you'll be able to, you know, have your take on what's going on. But first, want to get into, you know, what happened over at the Barclays Center. You did have like a fight card that was shown on Showtime Live over at the Barclays Center. Pretty much featured a couple of guys from Cuba out there, pretty much on the, you know, undercard before the main event, which was Brian Carlos Castano versus Arislandi Lara. You know, you also had a few other guys that were fighting on that undercard. Actually, a few guys that were, you know, in there that's from the Washington, D.C. area, you know, was taking part in this particular fight card, too, as Tyreek Irby was fighting on this card, and also Gary Antonio Russell was part of the fight card. But, you know, wanted to, you know, just get into first the co-feature bout that happened there on Showtime, which included the heavyweights Luis King Kong Ortiz versus Christian Hammer. As you know, you had Ortiz there with the record of 30-1, you know, coming off, you know, pretty much three fights actually last year. And so he's pretty much had his, he was going into his fourth fight in 1 year. He, you know, was at the Barclays Center on March 3rd of last year against Deontay Wilder. Lost that fight. And then, you know, ended up fighting Ruslan Kajanu. And then after that Kajanu fight, I was fighting Travis Kaufman on December 1st. And now he was able to be in there in the Barclays Center against Christian Hammer. Christian Hammer, who, you know, had fought Tyson Fury before, also Alexander Povetkin before this particular matchup, but was coming in there with a record of 24 wins and 5 losses. You know, had a couple of victories in 2018 before being put into this matchup against Luis Ortiz. And so, you know, what was looking into this particular matchup to see what would be going on between Luis Ortiz and Christian Hammer. You know, going over the past few fights that Christian Hammer had, you know, like I said, against Tyson Fury, where he got stopped, and, you know, losing by decision to Alexander Povetkin, you know, was going to try to see if, you know, he was going to be able to hold his own against Luis Ortiz, or if he was going to get stopped in that particular matchup. And I also wanted to see where Luis Ortiz was, because, you know, there's a lot of people that want to talk about Luis Ortiz and his particular status in the heavyweight division. So I wanted to see if he would be able to, you know, impress people in this particular matchup, because for me, you have those guys that are at the top of the division: Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, Dillian White. Those are the guys that are pretty much, you know, either, you know, fights that are that needed to be had in order to put them in that particular position, or they've, you know, done the things that they needed to do to kind of like separate themselves from the rest of the heavyweight division. And so, you know, here with Luis Ortiz, I wanted to see if they kind of like consider him to be amongst the top guys or the top five in the heavyweight division, then he should be able to, you know, go in there and take care of business against Christian Hammer. Considering seeing how Christian Hammer looked a little bit, I would say on the, you know, he had a couple of, you know, tires in there in the middle. I wouldn't necessarily say that he was like a Michelin man out there, but at least he, you know, kind of, you know, had a little bit of, you know, weight coming in there in the middle. So you had this fight there. It's a co-feature bout. Luis Ortiz, you know, kind of like looked like he was, you know, still trying to be active, still looking like he was bouncing, you know, with his feet and moving around a little bit. But, you know, kind of like saw a few things that, you know, showed a few openings from Luis Ortiz. You know, he had, of course, people were trying to watch out for, you know, his left hand. They say that he has a, you know, very dangerous left hand. But, you know, when those first couple of rounds when he was trying to, you know, let go of that left hand, Christian Hammer was, you know, answering with that right hand of his, and, you know, caught Luis Ortiz a few times there. The only thing that was, you know, really a difference was that Luis Ortiz is much more active in those first few rounds as far as like pumping a jab and then, you know, trying to set up his left hand. But he was getting caught a couple of times with the right hand of Christian Hammer. And then I would say within the middle part of the fight, you kind of seen Luis Ortiz mix up his attack a little bit, go upstairs, go downstairs, and work downstairs. A few times where he caught Christian Hammer with a few good shots down there in the midsection that stopped Christian Hammer there a little bit, and he kind of like showed that he was, you know, fairly hurt by those shots. But for me, I didn't necessarily see Luis Ortiz follow through with that attack, because he saw that, you know, it was a weakness for Christian Hammer, but he didn't continue on that in order to, you know, eventually break him down and then take out Christian Hammer later on in the fight. I would say, you know, round 7 and 8, you know, Luis Ortiz kind of like dropped his overall activity and output, and, you know, allowed Christian Hammer to get him a couple of times, but nothing like really significant to seriously hurt Luis Ortiz, where, you know, on the other side, Luis Ortiz had those chances earlier in the fight where he did kind of affect Christian Hammer, but just didn't follow through with it. And, you know, pretty much it went to the 10th round, and he was able to, you know, just stick in there, do his boxing thing, and, you know, just keep his range from Christian Hammer, and had the fight go to the scorecards where he nearly scored a shutout victory in all three scorecards there for him to get the win over Christian Hammer. Only one, well, pretty much actually two judges, my fault, gave Christian Hammer one round out of those 10 rounds. But Luis Ortiz is able to move to 31-1 in this particular matchup. And he said that, he was just, trying to work out his boxing skills and, that, nothing was wrong with his left hand because, Jim Gray was trying to bring up that his, left hand wasn't being used as much as I guess people expected it to be. But maybe it was just, something that he couldn't necessarily do after, six or seven rounds. Real quick, wanted to add in a caller, 646 is in the building. What's up? You're on the Boxing Source Radio Show.
Yo, JR, man, what's up, man? It's your boy, Batman. Kind of hard to listen to you try to tear down the great Luis King Kong Ortiz, man. You don't sound like you were impressed with his performance, JR. What's going on with that, man?
Wait. I'm just putting in an honest assessment of what went down in the fight between Luis Ortiz and Christian Hammer. I mean, it wasn't like, Luis Ortiz was boxing circles all over Christian Hammer, man.
He was, man. Listen. Luis Ortiz gave that kid a boxing lesson. At 39 years old, Luis Ortiz came into the fight only 238 pounds. Luis Ortiz threw an average of 61 punches per round, which is what, like 16 or 17 above the heavyweight average at 39 years old. This guy was never in danger. All he did was box, box, box. Even when Hammer tried to go on the run, Luis Ortiz chased him down, cornered him. He was still able to box him. He made great adjustments because he noticed that Hammer had like a decent quick right-hand counter. So what did he do? He switched to using the right hand and still beat him. This was a complete masterful boxing lesson. This was high boxing IQ. This was high quality work by a 39-year-old OG that nobody seems to want to fight, except Deontay Wilder, of course.
You did say that he is 39 years old. Have you seen a certified copy of his birth certificate?
Listen, we made one. Listen, you have to understand something. It doesn't matter how old Luis Ortiz is because he is still getting it done. And if all these heavyweights, and I know the boxing fans, the social media fans, they want to take little pops to Luis Ortiz because he didn't get the stoppage. If they think that it is so easy to beat Luis Ortiz, send the contract. I'm talking to you, Dillian White. Send the contract, please. Let's see you put your money where your mouth is. Don't think just because you say, oh, I'm going to beat somebody, that's just it. No, you have to actually step in the ring and do it. So, Dillian White, he doesn't have a dance partner for a July bout that he's going to have in London. Why not Luis Ortiz? Why not Luis Ortiz?
I have a question about that. So last year, when they were talking about, this whole, which is pretty much the same situation what we have this year, that Dillian White was looking for a dance partner at the O2 Arena, and Dillian White said that Luis Ortiz had his chance to fight him on July 28th, but didn't necessarily go for all of that and ended up fighting Razvan Khejanov instead on July 28th. My thing is that So you're not going to buy what Dylan White said about that instance last year?
Why would we? When the WBC ordered the fight, he said he didn't want the fight because it's for the second mandatory. He was on record as saying that. So he can't then go backtrack and say, well, we were going to have the fight, but we saw T didn't want it. Like, we heard you. We heard what you and your promoter said. You didn't want the fight. And then when the fight again, you brought up the fight in December. You're talking junk about Luis Ortiz. You want to challenge him, and then he accepts your challenge, but then you fight Derek Chisora instead. I don't want to hear from Dillian White or anyone defending Dillian White as it pertains to Luis Ortiz. Don't fight him on paper. Fight him in the ring and prove that he's this washed-up guy that you're going to beat easily. Stop talking about it and do it. You don't have a fight in July. Dominic Brazil is more than likely going to fight Wilder. So maybe you could entice the WBC to let you fight for the interim title against the next-ranked guy that you can make a fight with, which would be Luis Ortiz. Make it happen.
Well, the thing about it is that you had Luis Ortiz and Dylan White. And you're talking about the whole thing about what the WBC was ordering. Now, the thing about that is that you had two things wrong with that. Number one, Luis Ortiz had been coming off the loss against Deontay Wilder. So why would you put someone who just lost the fight that was for the world title to be, you know, to try to put him, like, back in, you know, close contention for the WBC title. And then have it as a second mandatory, you know?
Okay.
The thing about it was is that Dillian White didn't want that fight to be for a second mandatory. He wanted it to be for the mandatory. So if he fought Ortiz and won, he would be the mandatory for the WBC title. Otherwise, it would have been a waste of time for him to try and do that. When he ended up fighting Joseph Parker, by winning that fight, he became the number one position for the WBO championship. So that's why he fought Joseph Parker then, because
mm-hmm.
he had already went through the whole thing with the WBC before, and then he was just going to fight Ortiz and become the second mandatory when the WBC themselves haven't even enforced the first mandatory since November 2017. And even then, it wasn't really supposed to be that, because that was the originally scheduled bout for Wilder and Ortiz. So they
mm-hmm.
would have had the mandatory be sidestepped once again.
Now, let me ask you a question. I'm not sure if you saw the story that came out with Dillian White. Apparently, he thinks that if Dominic Brazil goes on to fight Deontay Wilder in May, that he should automatically be named the WBC mandatory. Do you agree with that, yes or no?
I saw a video about that is, you know, if Deontay Wilder ends up fighting Dominic Brazil, that he becomes the mandatory. I mean, if that fight does happen, then for me, I don't see why the WBC wouldn't name White the next mandatory contender. But that doesn't mean that I expect the WBC to do that.
They shouldn't do
because,
it.
Oh, man.
So here's the thing.
So let's go through this scenario then.
Okay.
So
you would have Brazil fight Deontay Wilder for the WBC title. Okay? Deontay Wilder wins and, you know, still holds the title, right? So then why would Dillian Whyte have to go through even more hoops to try to be in a position that he had already fought for in those previous fights?
Okay, let me ask you a question. Simple question, because I already know your answer because you've talked about it before. When Bermain Stiverne for the mandatory shot against Wilder, right? You remember Povetkin got suspended by the WBC, and the WBC automatically installed Bermain Stiverne as the mandatory. I remember you stating that you did not agree with that decision. You thought that he should have fought someone to become the mandatory, not just being named the mandatory. So I think this situation with Dillian Whyte is completely similar.
I completely disagree with that. I completely disagree with that. And I'm going to tell you why. The thing with Bermain Stiverne, right?
Mm-hmm.
He fought Deontay Wilder in January 2015 and lost to Deontay Wilder in January 2015. His next fight did not take place until December of 2015. After that, he wasn't even scheduled for another fight throughout that year of 2016. No one heard from him. You didn't have like any possibilities. So when that whole thing when the whole thing with Wilder and Povetkin took place, that kind of like delayed the whole thing with Povetkin. That tied Povetkin up, but it didn't tie Stiverne up. So ever since that fight with Deontay Wilder, he had one fight against Derek Rossi where he got knocked down in the first round and ended up getting that decision. Mm-hmm. How in the world was he elevated up to number two by having that one particular fight?
Because he's
Wilder had someone in Dillian Whyte that ever since, what was it? Let's see, he had four fights in 2016. Then you had that one fight against Malcolm Tan in 2017 before he fought Robert Hellenius, right?
Yeah.
So he ends up fighting Lucas Brown and wins against Lucas Brown. So he's been much more active than Bermain Stiverne, and he was much more active than Dominic Brazil, because Brazil, after that fight that he had against Eric Molina in November 4th of 2017, he didn't have a fight for over 12 months, which is pretty much the same thing that happened with Bermain Stiverne after he lost to Deontay Wilder for the WBC title. So why is it that Dillian Whyte would not be able to be in that particular position when he had been much more active in the ring and fought guys that were within the WBC rankings around that time? It doesn't make sense.
So you don't think?
But this is the WBC
we're talking
about. He
should have to fight to earn it. So you don't think he should have to fight to earn this mandatory opportunity?
What did Dominic Brazil? Did Dominic Brazil or Bermain Stiverne fight anybody to earn that opportunity?
Dominic Brazil did. He did. JR, he did. Whether or not you agreed with the level of opposition does not negate the fact that he fought for the mandatory position.
Hey, this show is coming off to a very good start, boy. Oh, man. Hey, look. Come on, bro. So, wait. So you're going to tell me that because because Promoter Vernon put in to fight Deontay Wilder on November 4th.
Yeah.
And the best thing that they could do for Dominic Brazil, who was, you know, not even within the top five of the WBC rankings at the time, to face someone in Eric Molina, who wasn't even in the top 10. And because he wins that fight, he's named the mandatory for the WBC championship. Come on,
absolutely,
man. Like, this is the type of stuff that people
that
are complaining
right
about with the WBC, man. Why do you think people continue to slam the WBC for antics like that? And
so why,
like I said,
if all Dillian White as a mandatory without having him fight, he was going to fight for the interim title, which would have made him the mandatory. So what is the difference if they find him a suitable replacement opponent?
Who, Brazil?
No, White. Because we know Brazil's going to fight Wilder. We know, although it's not official, that's going to happen. So if Brazil versus White was going to be for the interim title, which would have made him the mandatory for Wilder, why shouldn't he fight a credible opponent for the interim title to become the mandatory? Why should he just be elevated? It doesn't make any sense. Like, you
he already beat Joseph Parker, though.
Making that mistake before with the Vernon Povetkin.
Yeah, but here's the thing. He had already beat Joseph Parker, though. And Joseph Parker,
that was not a WBC
was part of the rankings at that time.
The Joseph Parker fight was not a WBC-sanctioned fight.
It wasn't?
No. You don't remember?
How?
When, he went, no, JR, let me refresh your memory. You don't remember when he they wanted him to fight Ortiz, said it was going to happen. He turned around and decided to fight Parker, and then the WBC pulled him from the rankings. You don't remember that?
Pulled who?
They pulled White from the rankings after he declined to
you
fight
can't,
Ortiz.
They can't pull White from the rankings. He's
they
the silver, he's
they
the
are.
Silver
they
champion.
They pulled him from the rankings.
He's the silver champion. So wait, so you're telling me that the fight between them and White and Joseph Parker was not a WBC sanctioned fight?
No, that's what I'm telling you. That exactly what I'm
okay,
telling
so
you.
Okay, so why was the WBC silver title on the line?
To fight Ortiz.
Why was this WBC silver title on the line?
It's always on. WBC did not sanction, I'm telling you.
Why would wait, so the WBC didn't sanction a fight that was
no.
That was for a title that they have under them. That's brand new right there, man. Hey, I'm going to have to look into that one because
please.
We all know
when
that
they ordered him to fight Luis Ortiz
between
he said he wouldn't do
the
it.
Two people that are going back and forth here that one of those two people doesn't fact check. So
listen, you can fact check this. I remember this. Okay, I didn't dream it. I did not imagine it. I remember the WBC ordered him to fight Ortiz in April. I remember that. He said he was not going to do it because he felt betrayed and all this other garbage that he was talking about. So he decided against fighting him. He decided to fight Parker instead, and then the WBC had temporarily pulled him from the rankings.
Temporarily pulled him from the rankings.
Yes. Yes, they did.
Well, since this is on audio record, I will look from that point that they had made the fight between White and Parker until that actual fight to see if Dillian White was pulled from the WBC rankings.
Okay.
Because it's funny that you could pull someone from the WBC rankings and that same person still hold one of your titles.
Hey, it'd be like that sometimes.
Oh, man. Well, just moving forward then, since you have doubts that Dillian White will face Luis Ortiz says that, hey, he's ready to,
go after the world titles one more time. It's what's kind of interesting is that you say that, hey, I mean, Dillian Whyte's available for July, but hey, Deontay Wilder may be available for July too, and it's not like we've heard anything about the WBC ordering the mandatory to happen yet. So why not have Wilder Ortiz rematch?
JR, listen, you are inside the boxing business. You know he's fighting Dominic Brazil May 18th. You know that's what's going to happen.
I mean, hey, you say that, you know, Luis Ortiz gave a boxing lesson in this particular fight. So maybe he's, you know, ready to have that rematch against Deontay Wilder.
Not in May.
Nah, they'll push it back. They'll push it back to July. I mean, you know, Wilder doesn't necessarily have a, you know, officially a dance partner yet, so why not?
You're a jerk.
I mean, all right. Let's go ahead and touch on that main event that happened there at the Barclays Center between Aris Landy Lara and Brian Carlos Castaño was for the WBA, super welterweight title there. Of course, you had Aris Landy Lara that hadn't fought since his very close and very competitive fight between him and Jared Hurd. Over in Las Vegas last April. And Brian Carlos Castaño is there coming in at 15-0. Had won the regular version of, or whatever the world title is for the WBA back in March of last year against Cedric Vitu. So he was, you know, coming up in competition against Aris Landy Lara, and, you know, this probably would have been, you know, his opportunity to just say, hey, this is my chance to make a statement there in the super welterweight division, to be somebody that is, you know, very experienced, has been in a lot of big fights before, and, you know, had his fights against, you know, the likes of Canelo Alvarez, Austin Trout, like I said, Jared Hurd, Alfredo Angulo. Who?
Vonis Matarosian, the Triple G legend.
Vonis Matarosian, and we can't forget the classic main event that Aris Landy Lara had
that
at the Barclays Center against Terrell Gausha.
One of the worst fights in boxing history.
And I still can't figure out how that particular match became the main event of that that 154-pound triplehead. I still can't, you know, understand how that is. But he was back there in the Barclays Center. The American Dream, Aris Landy Lara, going up against Brian Carlos Castaño, and, you know, this fight was, you know, fairly, you know, competitive fight. You know, I thought it was, you know, very close in pretty much many of the rounds that, you know, did take place. However, you did have, you know, Castaño, be very active, especially in the first half of the fight. I thought he was, you know, throwing and landing a few combinations on Aris Landy Lara. You didn't necessarily see Lara be, I would say, as mobile as he had been in the past few fights. So we kind of like had to fight a little bit differently in this particular matchup than he did in the past. But, you know, we did go through all 12 rounds, and it was fairly close throughout. And then it ended up being a, you know, split decision draw there as one fighter got a, you know, seven rounds of five. The other fighter got seven rounds of five. And then Julie Letterman gave both of the guys six rounds each for it to be a draw. So Castaño
keeps that WBA super welterweight title, and Lara gets another draw on his record. That is the third draw that he's had in his career. But
how did you score the fight?
Oh, what was that?
How did you score the fight?
I thought it was like a draw. There was like a few hard rounds to score, but the thing about it is that the way that the Showtime commentators were like looking at the fight was like it was, you know, very close between like the punches landed in each round. I'm like, nah, man, yeah, it was, you know. So it's kind of like, you know, I didn't really see where you had either fighter have the momentum for, you know, most of the fight. It kind of like changed back and forth, you know, almost, you know, every other round for me.
I thought the fight was close. I did favor Lara slightly, but I wasn't mad at the draw. I wasn't mad at people who thought Castano won. I thought there were a lot of rounds that were basically 50-50. I was actually surprised by the punch that the Showtime guys had to be surprised too. I'm like, yeah, you know, punch stats don't tell the whole story. And I think that this fight is a great example of that. Because if you just look at the punch stats, you would wonder how the hell Castano didn't just win the fight. But if you watch the actual fight, you would see Lara was landing very cleanly. He was boxing and basically in the pocket. To me, Lara was controlling a lot of the action. He was landing the more cleaner, more effective punches. And I think if you just look at the punch stats, you wouldn't know that. You know? I thought the draw was fair. I'm not mad at that. I want to see a rematch, to be honest with you. I don't think we'll get one because, you know, the fight didn't do well commercially. So I'm pretty sure you're probably not going to get a rematch, or maybe the rematch will be on some undercard somewhere. But overall, I think it was a very exciting fight. It was a damn good fight, a good card overall. And I think both guys come out looking good in the matchup.
Both did kind of like look good. And, you know, maybe a possibility that there may be a rematch. Just, you know, depends on, you know, how, you know, people kind of like, you know, received it, you know, who, you know, watched it on TV and those that were in attendance. But, you know, for me, looking at, you know, some of the camera angles that were there from Showtime, and it seemed like there was like a lot of dark shade that was around the majority of the arena, and you didn't really see that many camera shots that gave like a full view of the Barclays Center there for this particular fight. So
that was there.
What was that?
Like 7,800 people.
They said the attendance was 7,800.
Yeah.
Okay. That, you know, that kind of is like wait, what was the? I gotta look at the thing for the attendance for that fight card for the Charlos, because I think that was around that same range. I think. You know,
yeah, I think it was.
But yeah, and you know, that's kind of you know, it's kind of interesting there, because I thought that, you know, they would have had a little bit more people there. Actually, it says that for the Charlo card, they had a crowd of 9,177.
Yeah.
You know, so
But, you know, going into this card, I was like, y'all have those, you know, Cuban, you know, fighters kind of like highlighting the card. I thought it was, you know, they would have had in a location, you know, more closer to, you know, maybe Miami or something like that. But, you know, maybe New York had like a, you know, a little bit of crowd, a Cuban contingent out there. But I just, you know, kind of like found it weird that they would, you know, have a card like that be stationed at the Barclays Center. Instead of, like, you know, maybe somewhere else, like we're saying, like Miami or something like that. But for this particular matchup, if they, you know, try to see if they could come up with a rematch for him, I'm not sure if they're going to have it as a main event in something later on down the line. It may be like, let's say if what was it? Charlo's rematch, you know, against Tony Harrison. They'll, you know, put that Castaño Alara fight, you know, as a co-feature bout to that. That maybe that could work. But, you know, other than that, I really don't see like those two going at each other again, being as part of a main event. So, and, you know, as far as, like, the overall reception to that fight, I don't know if they, like, you know, people are, like, really clamoring to see that be an immediate rematch compared to, like, say, the fight between, you know, Charlo and Tony Harrison. So that's the thing that I pretty much got out of that. There. So, you know, with Laura Castaño, I mean, I kind of, you know, see that rematch happened a little bit later on down the line, but I mean, for me, I thought Castaño could have made a statement against somebody that was, you know, kind of like that hadn't been in the ring for a while and just, you know, kind of like blitz him and, you know, overwhelm him so that he wouldn't be able to throw much back, but he couldn't, you know, keep that consistent attack going over the course of 12 rounds right there. All right, about to put in another caller on the line, area code 813. What's going on? You're on the Boxing Source Radio Show.
Hey, what's up, Jay? This is 12 from Tampa. Just once again, glad you're calling. Just talking about the sport of boxing, which we all love. And even just, I'm not sure how much you got into the Laura Castaño fight, but I was able to see that fight. And this, well, first thing first, on the pre-fight interview, they interviewed Erickson Lubin. And he said, who do you think is going to win the fight? And very interesting enough, and what's funny about it, he said he called it a draw. And when I first heard that, I said, a draw? I said, you rarely hear someone say the result's going to be a draw. And actually, what's funny, he actually called it correctly. Lara didn't do anything special. He pretty much fought like he typically fights. He counterpunches and pretty much the entire fight, going backwards. Really, does he take a defensive approach within the fight? Just as was the case last night, he just simply just tried to counterpunch, and at times brilliantly. But keep in mind, Lawrence 35 years old. He hasn't fought in almost a year. So that, and of course we all know his last fight was against Hurd, was a rough fight. We know that, but he's had more than enough time to recuperate mentally and physically, things like that. And here we got with Castaño coming in at 15-0 from Argentina, 11 knockouts, stuff like that. But basically trying to go from prospect status to contender status in this regard. The main thing I noticed about Castaño, good action, good energy throughout the fight. But is he world class? I don't think so. If even if Castaño was to win that fight last night, right? And how would you project him in the ring with against any other champions or anybody else at the top of that of the 154 division? Would he win? And I mean, it would be competitive to a degree, but I don't think he's world class though in that regard. So if they rematch, it in a sense makes sense. I don't think it needs a headline of card though again, but really, it kind of went to as expected, but. But even with Lawrence, he had so many opportunities just to go on offensive and get some rounds in. Because at least sometimes he did match the energy, the output of Cassano in some rounds. But for the most, you had Cassano coming forward throwing his combinations, and you had, for the most, you had Lauer for the entire fight, for the most, just doing, being a counter puncher. So it was a draw. It was funny. Lexi, once again, is called by Erickson Lubin correctly, and it is what it is. And kind of what we talked about, did Lauer get older? You can kind of say, you can definitely see the difference between the two ages of the two combatants last night. Was that a factor? Possibly. Did Lauer get older? Possibly. Is he still world class? And once again, possibly. But it was a decent fight.
Well, to that point about, you know, if Lara has, you know, got significantly older, you know, that was something that, you know, we were trying to look out for in this fight against Cassano. And, you know, while it seemed like he, you know, did have a couple of lapses in defense a little bit, he was still, you know, able to come back and attack Cassano a few times and get him with a few combinations while, you know, trying to weather what Cassano had to do. But if he is, you know, getting, you know, age, if age is pretty much catching up to him, as far as that rematch goes, they would, you know, want to see if they could push to have that fight happen sooner rather than later, so that, you know, he would be able to see if he could get at least a piece of a world title at Super Welterweight before, you know, trying to see if he could go after one of those other champions there at 154 pounds. Got another caller in here, Eric 0205. What's going on? You're on the Boxing Swords Radio Show.
Hey, what's going on, James? What's going on, Terrell? This is Mike Grady. How y'all doing?
Dude. All right, we're chilling here. Just talking about that fight card in the Barclays Center.
Oh, okay. Y'all already spoke on everything?
We did. Just going on the part about Lara and Cassano, we'll probably revisit Ortiz and Christian Hammer here in a bit after we get your thoughts on that Lara Cassano fight.
So I guess we could all see that Lara is turning into an older fighter, meaning that all of the energy that he used to be able to take with moving, he's a bit more cautious now than to expend all of that energy, because I need to go back and watch the Jared Hurd fight, but I know they were making mention that he stood still a lot more in the Jared Hurd fight. I think he hit Jared Hurd a bunch, but I thought he was moving. I could be wrong. I need to go back and watch it. But, yeah, like, the young guys, most of them, their motor can go for a while, and so he can't move and then expect to be able to be sustained for 12 rounds. So I think that's a big change that probably, I forgot the trainer, but they probably make him sit down on his punches more too now to make people like respect him, quotation marks, a bit more. But the fight to me, like I watched the fight, but it was like, I was, like, dozing away from it every now and then. Maybe I was doing something else, but, like, I would watch it and then I would go to something else. And it was kind of a mundane fight to me. It was, like, kind of boring. It was kind of boring to me. I'm just being real. It was kind of boring. So maybe because I was doing something else, and that's probably why I wasn't watching it, but it just seemed repetitive, like the exact same thing kept continuing to happen. And then I guess it got interesting because the young guy got tired, and or he got more tired. But one would have thought that, you know, if he just kept pressing, he would have, like, pressure with a bust pipes type thing. But it seemed like his motor gave up a little quicker than what I would have expected, because I thought he was going to continue pressuring him, and it was going to be very similar to the Jared Hurd fight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I thought that, you know, his Cassano, like I was saying, you know, here earlier before he got on, I thought Cassano would have been able to, you know, use some type of pressure on Aroslandi Lara to kind of, like, you know, make Lara have to react to what Cassano was doing. While they were, you know, a couple of instances where he was doing that, he kind of like, you know, dropped off in that overall productivity round by round. And, you know, for me, kind of let Lara get back into it by doing that. And, you know, as a result, you had this fight end up being a draw there between those two. And, you know, as far as like, you know, where this puts, you know, either fighter, that kind of like just, you know, has them there just a, you know, little shade below those that are on the top of the division. And, you know, Tony Harrison, Jermell Charlo, Jared Hurd, and Jaime Munguia. So, I mean, the thing about it is that, you know, with those two guys, they should have been able to go in there and make a statement to kind of like, you know, put them in the mix to try to say that they're among the top guys in the division. But you didn't really see that much from either fighter that kind of like separated one from the other. And so now, you know, like we were saying earlier, they're going to have a rematch, and that rematch for Lara's case should happen sooner rather than later, since he had already been, you know, inactive for about, you know, 11 months before this fight took place. Just real quick, you know, while, you know, have you on and Terrell on, before y'all got on, I did go over the fight between Luis Ortiz and Christian Hammer, where Luis Ortiz ended up getting a unanimous decision. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that. I'm going to start with Mike first and then Terrell.
So I thought it was definitely a more exciting fight than the Lara fight. And possibly that was because Ortiz looked more vulnerable. And can we say he was, like, really in danger of like, being beat? Possibly not, but I think if Christian Hammer would have landed one of those right hands, which he was actually throwing pretty straight, in my opinion. He was throwing it very straight, and he hit him quite a few times. He hit him, you know, like more times than what I'm used to Ortiz getting hit. And so Ortiz looked vulnerable in this fight, and like he couldn't get away from the right hand. And like, or what's his name just had his time, and he was kind of doing this whole, you know, biding his time, letting Ortiz like come toward him, and then he would just like just throw the right hand, then it would hit him. I always enjoy watching Ortiz fight, because Ortiz, the way he like hand fights and the way he uses his hand for controlling people and kind of like limiting another person's offense, it's beautiful to watch. And I also have an affinity for it too, because when I used to like try to fight and stuff, that's kind of the thing that I like doing as well too. Like, you know, you shouldn't let people hit you type thing. So yeah, Ortiz, I like watching him fight, but he looks vulnerable, so maybe that'll make the other people want to get in the ring with him because he looked older. And maybe his age catching up with him, or maybe it was just the style. Maybe he didn't train good enough, because the Luis Ortiz that we saw fighting Deontay Wilder was a lot more chopper, was like a lot more alert. But that same Luis Ortiz, his motor went out. So maybe he was trying to be mindful of his motor. Maybe he took him not as seriously. I mean, it's a bunch of maybes that you could say. But he won the fight. He got hit a bunch, or hit enough a bunch. And hopefully these guys will get in the ring with him now, and we can actually see some real heavyweight fight.
So you wouldn't necessarily call it a boxing lesson from Luis Ortiz that night?
Would I call it a boxing lesson? No, because he got hit so much. Like, I wouldn't call it a lesson, because he won a boxing match, but he got hit quite a bit. Hit clean, too. Like, maybe not clean enough to, like, knock him out clean, but, and his head probably wasn't snapping back either, but he was just getting hit very clean with the right hand. So, would I call it a boxing lesson? A very moderate one. Like, he won a boxing match. Like, he won a boxing lesson. Yes, he did give him a boxing lesson, but and Hammer wasn't trying to there and win, per se. He was just trying to be respectable. I can't say he was out there trying to win. Like, he hit him a few times, but the only way he would have won that fight if he would have caught him with something big and then hurt Luis Ortiz like that. Otherwise, Ortiz was winning the fight. I mean, it was competitive because Hammer was doing all his posturing and theatrical stuff, and, you know, it just looked good in terms of a fight that fans would want to watch. But in terms of competitiveness, it was one-sided, interesting rounds.
Yeah, I mean, my thing was, you know, I thought that Luis Ortiz had that left hand a little bit low to be successful for Hammer's right hand. The only thing was with Hammer is that he just didn't throw anything other than the right hand for most of the fight. So it was just that, you know, he was, you know, either getting caught by Ortiz's jab or blocking Ortiz's jab and then getting followed up with that left hand, or he would just, you know, try to, you know, bait Ortiz in a couple of times and then catch it with that right hand and then, you know, move out of the, pocket or out of the corner or something like that. Terrell, what was your thoughts about that Ortiz Hammer fight?
Yeah, it was a decent heavyweight fight. Didn't know much about Hammer going into the fight. The first thing that you notice about the guy from the wind, Hammer carries considerable size. I think he came in at 257 for this fight, whereas Ortiz came in at 238. But despite that, still very similar size between the two combatants and everything. But Hammer's, what, I think 24-5, something like that. I mean, he's a big body. He's a big body, you know. So with limited skills, I mean, like I said, pretty much all he did was pretty much throw the fight right-handed to try to fight. Other than that, no real jabs, things like that. Not really setting up his punches or combinations, things like that. So, like I said, a limited fighter, Ortiz. I mean, that's kind of the classic Ortiz that we expected. But I tell you what, Ortiz turns 40 years old towards the later part of this month, I believe it is. And I tell you what, did he look older? Maybe. And kind of to the point what Michael said, kind of has some of his skills diminished. And I tell you what, if I'm Wilder and I saw that fight, I would, and in lieu of the fact that Wilder Fury 2 is not going to happen right now, in a sense, I'll be jumping at the opportunity to, hey, you know what, let me go and fight Ortiz again, give him that rematch that he's doing for, and therefore get another win against this guy. Because, one, you've already beat the guy, so you already riding that confidence that you can beat this guy again. And given what I saw last night, if I was Wilder, I would go and I would just say, F it. Let's go and fight again. Because in a sense, Ortiz did look a little bit slower to me, you know. Because at the same time, on the other side, Hammer wasn't exactly pushing him throughout the fight. As far as fighting forward, great setup, speeding up the pace of the fight, things like that. Hammer wasn't doing that, mm-hmm. And that's something that Wilder can do, being that he's a younger guy, right? So. Actually, if I was Wilder, I'd be looking to fight him again and just go and get that over with and fight out the way. You know, locking me a day for the summer, things like that. But, like I said, Hammer, once again, just a limited fighter. I thought that Ortiz was going to go ahead and get him out of there, but that didn't happen. But, once again, Hammer's a big guy, so he was able to take a lot of punishment. And it was pretty funny, too, because there were several exchanges where Ortiz just hit them right to the body, right to the chest. and those punches affected Hammer. You know, keep in mind, he's coming from another heavyweight fighter, but there's a lot of body work, a difference between two classes of fighters. Like I said, Hammer's a big guy, we know that, but not just very limited skill set. So not much you can do towards that and getting him back to get a win. So that's what we have.
I got some more addition. I have an addition I want to add on to after the tutorial. I'll let you go say something.
Oh, I was just going to ask Darrell the same question that I asked Brother Matt earlier in reference to Luis Ortiz. So, I mean, they say that Luis Ortiz is 39 years old. I asked Matt this, and I'm going to ask you this. Have you seen a certified copy of Luis Ortiz's birth certificate?
I saw a mention on Twitter, but I'll see that to you guys later so you can get a good laugh. But no, I have not seen a copy of his certificate, birth certificate. But, you know, honestly.
All right. Go ahead there, Mike.
What does that have to do with his birth certificate?
I mean, people claim that he's 39 years old, but, I mean, yo, looking at him, it just doesn't seem like he's 39. He's the oldest 39-year-old I've ever seen, but go.
Oh, come on, JR. He still got his whole hairline, man. Leave that man alone.
He really do. So, for me, Ortiz didn't capitalize on the body shot. Like, Hammer,
yeah,
toward the end of the fight, toward the middle and end, tell he didn't like the body shot. And Ortiz,
yep,
like, wasn't going to that enough. So I think that's one like, thing that he probably should have made an adjustment with. But I could see him not going to the body as much because Hammer was hitting him with the right hand. And so I could see both of those making the other person, like, Ortiz not wanting to throw body shots because it leaves him more vulnerable to getting hit with the right hand. And then Hammer, to me, moved, like, fairly well, which is how he got through that fight, other than hitting. It's sort of like Adonis Stevenson. That's exactly who you could liken it to, Adonis Stevenson. Able to keep you off with a right hand. Okay, take away the power, but just the ability to, like, move around and look a little bit and then throw the strong hand. And then that's why the fight kind of, like, lasted so long.
Well, I mean the punch resistance that Christian Hammer had, you know, a little bit upstairs was, you know, a factor. But, you know, I just think that Luis Ortiz didn't throw enough caution to the wind. You know, like you were saying, the whole thing about, you know, throwing those shots to the body, knowing that they clearly affected Christian Hammer there, I would just, you know, continue to go downstairs. I mean, don't worry about that right hand. Just, you know, go downstairs a little bit and then follow up with the uppercut or, you know, left uppercut or left hook and be able to have Christian Hammer in, you know, more serious trouble because, I mean, the overall activity of Christian Hammer during the course of that fight didn't really give me much of a sense that, you know, he would have, you know, had Luis Ortiz in serious trouble. He didn't, you know, let his hands go. He didn't, you know, necessarily throw much with his, you know, left hand. He tried to I was going to say that he tried to do something that Wilder did, but no. At least Wilder actually threw a punch with his left hand instead of just, you know, trying to measure the range that they had between him and Ortiz. At least he threw the left hand. There was like a left jab out there. Christian Hammer just put his left hand out there and just left it there, you know, straight and didn't throw anything. And actually the referee had to, you know, step in and say, hey, you can't, you know, be doing that. So, you know, other than that, he really didn't have much to, like, put Ortiz in much of a bind there. So I thought, you know, Ortiz would have, you know, did something to become more aggressive and try to finish out the fight, you know, between the middle or late rounds, and he wasn't able to do that right there. You know, in the overtime session of the show, this will be, you know, available, you know, later on through Blog Talk Radio and also through Anchor.fm. So this will be available for those that want to subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Anchor.fm, you know, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. I wanted to, you know, look ahead to what's happening next week as we have, like, a few title fights that'll be scheduled. You're going to have Sean Porter going up against Yordanis Ugas for the WBC Welterweight Championship. You got Maurice Hooker defending his title against Miguel Lesbier. That's the WBO Super Lightweight Championship. And Dimitri Bivol
faces Joe Smith Jr. for the WBA light heavyweight title. First, going into this thing with Sean Porter and your Dennis Ugas, I talked about this particular fight once it got, put together. I really, not really sold on your Dennis Ugas that much, coming off that fight against Cesar Barrio Nuevo. I thought that, if he was, they were talking about him going after Errol Spence Jr., that he was a top contender for Errol Spence's title, and he was supposed to be, doing this and that. He did, have his win over Ray Robinson last year, but, coming from that fight against Barrio Nuevo, I just didn't think that he would be, enough to kind of like defeat the likes of a Sean Porter, who, basically is a dog there in the ring from round one to round 12 and will, come after you. For me, in order for, someone to defeat Sean Porter, you got to have like a very, very, very good jab and be able to control the distance against them. And I just don't see that from your Dennis Ugas coming up here on March 9th. And I expect Sean Porter to get the win here in this particular matchup. Matt, are you picking Porter or Ugas? I wasn't sure who you were picking next week.
I'm picking Porter by decision. I think Ugas is pretty durable, but I'm not too sure that he's on the level of a Sean Porter. He doesn't have much power, so I just find it hard to believe that he's going to be able to keep Porter from mauling him. And if it turns into a boxing match, I think Porter showed, even in his last fight against Danny Garcia, that Porter can box. So I'm struggling to find a way that Ugas beats Porter.
So what do you think would be next if Porter, gets this win over Ugas? Do you think he's going to, either try to have a unification against like a Thurman or something like that? Or what would be next? What do you think?
I think he's going to end up probably fighting the winner of Spence versus Garcia if the winner doesn't get Pacquiao. It all depends on what Pacquiao does. I did see recently that Pacquiao has said that he is currently in negotiations with Floyd Mayweather for a rematch. So who knows what Pacquiao is going to do. If Pacquiao doesn't fight the winner of Spence versus Garcia, I fully expect Porter to get the call for that fight.
Well, I mean, if there is enough interest for a rematch between Pacquiao and Mayweather, then all it takes is for Pacquiao to earn what did he get last time? 45 to 50 million for the first? No, it was much more than that.
Yeah, probably
it was like
more than
80 million.
Yeah,
80 million. So if he even gets like, I forgot what he got for Broner though.
But Broner, his minimum guarantee was 20.
Okay, minimum guarantee was 20. So, if he gets a guarantee of around 45 or 50,
even if he gets a guarantee around 30. I can see the fight happening.
But it just depends on what the guarantee for Mayweather would be in that time, because I don't see Mayweather going anywhere near Pacquiao unless if he's getting 80 to 100.
He could get that. Listen, I would buy the fight, okay? So they got one pay-per-view buy already. So don't tell me no one's going to buy this fight. I think that if they fight again, it's going to do over 2 million pay-per-view buys.
Yeah, I mean, hey, if they could have, Mayweather fight McGregor and they still was able to get about 4 million or so pay-per-view buys, then yeah, Yo, I don't see why that's not, you know, out of the cards. Terrell, what are you looking forward to with this Sean Porter, Yordan Zubic fight?
Yeah, I feel I'm definitely picking Porter on this fight as well. And I tell you what, I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up in a TKO victory for Porter. And the reason why I say that, we all know full well about Porter's rough and tumble style. Even like Matt just said, that Porter still has boxing skills despite that he's a rough guy in the ring. He does have boxing skills. He's now in the system, back on top with a belt again. I've heard the motivation to put on the show. Even like we talked about before in the past, Porter is a guy, even when he had his belt, he wasn't necessarily highly regarded in that sense. Didn't have a lot of flair coming towards his weight, despite the fact that he had the belt. He's just a working guy. That's who he is. We know that. But I guess Ugas, like I said, I really don't expect a whole lot. And just one thing to consider for, I want everyone to give an input when they get a chance. Who is the best Cuban boxer ever professionally, right? Even right now, I'm just thinking about in terms of like Brigandow, people like that. But as far as who had the most success professionally, that was Cuban. And certainly not going to be Ugas, because, I mean, at this point, he is what he is. And do I think he has enough to dethrone Porter and take his belt? No, I don't. Basically, Porter's going to rub this guy up. I wouldn't be surprised to see a couple of fouls from either side. But he just doesn't have enough. And Porter's back on top. He's going to do everything he can to keep that belt. Like I said, I wouldn't be surprised to see a TKO victory. But once again, Brigandow, Ugas, and people like that, who's been the best Cuban boxer, Ortiz, like that. I mean, all these guys have levels of success, but as far as the elite, I don't see it. And it's kind of funny, given that the history of Cuban boxing. So I would love to hear what you guys have to say about that, too.
What, in reference to the thing for Porter?
Yeah, well, just aside from that, who's why don't Cuban boxers have more success professionally, given their deep history in boxing, things like that?
Well, the thing for Cuban boxing professionally is that, you know, they kind of like had this whole thing with the amateur ranks, and I don't know why, but it seems like they kind of like stick in the amateur ranks for longer than, you know, many of the, you know, other guys that are competing within the amateur ranks, so that by the time that they do hit the professional ranks, all they have is about, what, let's say 6-7 years or so, 6 or 7 good years before they, you know, eventually get, you know, check out, or, you know, eventually get phased out of the professional game. And, you know, of course, there's also the whole thing with the business aspect of it. There's really not any overall demand for, you know, these fighters to get those, you know, matches that they need in order to prove that they're amongst the top in the division. So, I mean, you see how the, you know, whole thing is with Guillermo Rigondeaux. You know, he had his couple of fights, and then he fought, Vasyl Lomachenko, and it took him a couple of years before he was able to be put in a position to fight once again. You know, that's the thing I kind of like to get, you know, out of that one. Mike, what's your thoughts about this fight?
So I haven't really watched Ugas like that, so I can't really speak on it. But I'm pretty sure they did right in terms of matchmaking, because everyone would probably be more apt to want to see Thurman and Porter. So Porter probably going to get past this test. But I can't really speak on Ugas because I forgot. He's like a dark-skinned Cuban, right?
Yeah, he's like tall.
Okay.
Well, he's like kind of like tall for the, welterweight division, but.
Yeah, I can't really speak on it because I don't really. Like, I've seen Ugas fight, but I don't remember because I remember the name.
I mean, he's been on, like I said, he was part of that card for the Porter Garcia fight. And then he also had, you know, those fights against Thomas Lorman and Ray Robinson. But
forget he beat Jamal James, too.
Yeah, he had that, you know, a while back, too, back in 2016. And also, he did fight Amir Imam. that was a good time back, too, that he fought Amir Imam and, you know, ended up losing that fight. So, that's what we have with that. Just one more thing to touch on for next week. You do have a card there where at the Turning Stone Resort and Casino, where you're going to have Dimitri Bivol defending his light heavyweight title against Joe Smith Jr. and Maurice Hooker going up against Miguel Lespierre for the WBO Super Lightweight Championship. With Bivol, he has his next defense here against Joe Smith Jr. Coming off his win over John Pascal last November. And with Joe Smith Jr., he did have his fight against Bernard Hopkins, ended up losing against Sylvain Barrera, but now has his first world title shot here against Dimitri Bivol. And, looking at the past couple of fights that Bivol has had, he hasn't been, overly impressive. So going up against a guy in Joe Smith Jr. who, is kind of like known to have a little bit more power behind his punch. It's going to be interesting to see how Dimitri Bivol reacts to Joe Smith's punches, considering what he said after his fight against John Pascal. So that's going to be something to, kind of like look at. And, hey, I mean, I kind of like see Joe Smith Jr. really being very competitive in this particular fight. While on the co-feature, you're going to have Maurice Hooker going up against Miguel Lespierre. This is going to be his second defense of that WBO super lightweight title. Was able to, get this fight against Miguel Lespierre, who is, also undefeated. Coming out of Brooklyn, New York with Trinidad roots, but he's had, majority of his fights around the USA, but now has his first opportunity to go for a world title there. So he's had, an undefeated record so far, but, nothing as far as like any, significant bouts at super lightweight. He's only had a couple of 10-round fights in his professional career up to this point. So this is a major step up for Miguel Lespierre there. First, I'm going to start with Matt. What do you think about these two fights, in particular the Bivol-Joe Smith Jr. fight?
Man, I don't give a damn about this card. Another crap card. I don't want to hear nothing about this card, man. Just ask somebody else, man. I don't care about this card.
He says this card is wax sauce.
Yeah, man. Listen, the only time I want to see a hooker is when I'm in the mood for something, all right? Come on, man. Listen, Eddie Hearn promised us Dimitri Bivol versus Artur Beterbiev. Instead, we got Dimitri Bivol versus Joe Smith Jr. Come on, man. This is crap, man. I hope Smith gives a good account of himself. I'm not too confident in that. I think Bivol is a much better boxer than Smith. I don't think Smith is a very good boxer at all. Sullivan Barrera easily outboxed him, and he had basically no answers for him. I think you're going to see a replay of that. That's basically it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is if Bivol is able to, try to have some type of boxing skill against Joe Smith Jr., he should be able to, win fairly comfortably. But if he, ends up slacking off and gets caught a couple of times, then you could see Joe Smith there, have
Naval in a lot of trouble. So that's something that, you know, I'm kind of like looking out for in that one. Anything about it from you, Mike Grady?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So I guess I agree with Matt more so. The conventional wisdom says that B-Ball should be a much better boxer than Joe Smith Jr. And when Sullivan Barrera and B-Ball fought, it was a one-sided win for B-Ball, right?
Where? In which particular fight?
When Barrera and B-Ball fought, it was a one-sided victory for B-Ball?
No, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Was B-Ball, faster than him?
Yeah,
like, what was,
I mean, yeah, and then, you know, he eventually, you know, finished him off in the 12th round.
Oh, damn. I definitely forgot about that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was his first defense of that title.
It should be a pretty easy fight for B-Ball, but it'd be interesting to see if Joe Smith's style, like roughing somebody up, if B-Ball is not used to that. It'd be interesting to see if B-Ball is, like, soft and the same way Lomachenko or any one of these other guys can't really take somebody, like, bodying them. I think
well,
that's
Joe Smith
got to
do it.
Yeah, Smith isn't that type of guy though. Yeah, I don't think Smith is someone that kind of like, you know, goes forward and tries to get up close as possible to, and then try to work people on the inside, and then continues that type of pace throughout. He doesn't really, you know, quite do that. So yeah, I don't really expect that out of him. Anything from you about it, Terrell?
Yeah, just real quick, just kind of what you guys are alluding to. Bivol's a guy that does everything well, but not necessarily anything great. So he's just very solid fundamentally. Even in his last fight against Pascal, he didn't necessarily wow anybody against an older fighter in that regard. I think Pascal's like, what, 35, 36, 37, something like that. He's getting up there. But once again, Bivol, someone that does everything good, but not necessarily anything great. But I mean, despite Smith's somewhat limited boxing ability, you never know, power could be an equalizer in this fight. So it's certainly worth watching just for that aspect right there. That division is pretty hot right now. A lot of activity within that division. Some good potential matchups that we hope come to fruition. But once again, this fight itself, power could be an equalizer to it, just because that is worth watching. To see if something can happen different within that fight than the supposed expected result of the ball getting the win. It shouldn't be a necessarily easy win, but I mean, I don't know. Even with the ball Pascal, I'm certain sure they looked at that fight and hope he corrected some things that they thought that they saw in that fight and to make the ball better. But nevertheless, each matchup's not the same. Every fight's not the same. So you never know what Joe Smith has been working on as well on his side to make himself better and bring this fight going forward in the fact that he realized his first title opportunity. And, you know, so that's why, you know, anybody wants to do everything they can to grab that title because, you know, a title shot does not come up often at all. You got to work, stand in line, political, all kinds of stuff in order to get your title shot. So it's like I said, the fight's worth watching just for that. And real quickly, just going over to Maurice Hooker, I enjoyed his last title defense. He's a tall guy for that division. And he's a tall guy that knows how to fight tall. And at the same time, can get in inside as well. So it's going to be enjoyable to see him going for his next defense. And it's kind of want to get used to that name, Hooker. You know, it's a funny in a sense for obvious reasons or whatever. This is probably a guy that could probably do something and probably go up to 140 and beyond, given the size of his frame. So that's definitely worth seeing and going forward for that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is here, it's almost like Matt said, you kind of like, you know, wanted to see that fight between, you know, Dmitry Bivol and the thing there with Beterbiev, but, you know, this is, you know, what we have instead because, you know, Beterbiev chose to, you know, sign the fight, you know, elsewhere. So this is, you know, what you have left available there for Dmitry Bivol. So he should be able to get through this particular fight against Joe Smith. I mean, you know, for me, I think that, you know, Smith with this, you know, being his, you know, first world title defense, this is, you know, kind of like another, you know, step up in class for him. And, you know, we saw what, you know, he had against Sullivan Barrera, where he pretty much got boxed, you know, for pretty much like every round but the first round, while, you know, Bivol was able to, you know, go right through Barrera by the end of the particular fight. And, you know, I just kind of like see that if Bivol wants to, you know, really be impressive and try to, you know, get the fights that, you know, he's looking for, whether it is, you know, Beterbiev later on down the line or Sergey Kovalev, which was, you know, talked about last year before Kovalev lost, you know, there to Aledo Alvarez, that he needs to, you know, make a statement pretty much like he did when he got the title when it was vacant there. So, you know, what he has to do is, you know, have this fight against Joe Smith, be impressive, get Joe Smith out of there. Like Matt likes to say, if he, you know, if he's, you know, supposed to be that much better than likes Joe Smith, then he should be able to get Joe Smith out of there, you know, in a short amount of time. So for him to, like, kind of like put himself in a position to fight those other guys for the world titles, and he should be able to, you know, Joe Smith Jr. with no problem. And for the thing with Maurice Hooker, my thing is that he's – I think I said this before his previous fight, you know, when he had to, you know, go up against Alex Salcedo and he had to go to Salcedo's hometown in order to, you know, fight there, that, you know, other than that particular fight, he's going to have to look around to try to find a few people out there before – you know, until this whole World Boxing Super Series thing gets kind of like sorted out, which we don't necessarily know when it's going to be sorted out because we're having a few folks that are like unsure if they're going to be fighting. There might be replacements. People are threatening not being part of the World Boxing Super Series anymore. It's kind of like been a mess over the past couple of months or so. So we got to like see what happens there with the, you know, rest of the World Boxing Super Series before Maurice Hooker is able to, you know, go against any of those guys that are, you know, part of that tournament. So, you know, in the meantime, these are the type of fights that he's going to have until that whole thing gets sorted out. That pretty much covers, like, everything I wanted to cover in this particular episode of the show. You do have on March 16th that fight for the IBF welterweight title between Errol Spence Jr. and Mikey Garcia, but I'm going to touch on that particular fight in depth on next week's show. Is there anything else before I, like, roll out?
Does Joe Smith Jr. have good win?
I can't really say that he does or not, but I just know that, you know, the thing with Barrera, he kind of like looked like he was a little bit discouraged by the end of that particular fight, you know, where he couldn't really do that much against Barrera in the, like, second half of the fight. So, I mean, he's not somebody that, you know, really expounds a lot of energy during the course of the fight anyway, but he can you know, try to, you know, go for the big shot a few times.
So I mentioned that because Bivol, to me, he don't completely gas out or anywhere near it, but he kind of just, like, flatlines at some point, and he ain't just,
yeah,
like, fresh, in my opinion.
So
yeah,
he does,
maybe,
like, have those instances, but, you know, the thing about it is that, you know, he can't really, like I said, he can't really do that against Joe Smith and then expect to try to get the fights that he's looking for against the top guys at light heavyweight.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's all I
have. That's got. All right. So with that being said, I'll put a close to this episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show. I'll be back on next week, Sunday, March 10th, and you'll be able to get the this podcast on Anchor.fm and also through iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And like I say at the end of every show, Point of Boxing is a hit, and I get hit. Not to say in the trade. On that note, I'm out. Have a good evening, everybody.
Bomb squad, baby.